Amazon makes a big bid for Whole Foods, just chugging right along with its whole Amazon strategy for your entire life. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Ryssdal. It's Friday, June 16th. Thanks for joining us as we roll into this summer weekend with a big news Friday. I suspect you have heard by now that Amazon wants to buy Whole Foods in a roughly $13.5 billion deal. It would be Amazon's biggest acquisition to date. It is generating headline words such as earth-shaking. Whole Foods, of course, has been underperforming a little bit lately. Its growth has slowed, and activist investors have been after the chain to sell itself. But what does a digital retailer like Amazon want with all those old school brick and mortar stores? And can it turn things around at Whole Foods? Marketplace's Adrienne Hill gets us started.
The deal has retail experts pretty amped. Here's Professor Barbara Kahn from the Wharton School.
I can't tell you what a huge difference this could make in the retail environment, in my opinion.
And retail consultant Jan Rogers-Niffen.
This is the biggest thing that's happened in grocery since Walmart opened the first supercenter in 1988.
That's big. Amazon had already been experimenting with brick and mortar. If the deal goes through, it'll have about 460 Whole Foods stores. John Talbot is from the University of Indiana's Kelly School of Business.
I think it just really demonstrates how determined they are to really become a bricks and click retailer.
Bricks and click retailer. Catchy, right? A lot of traditional retailers, and Walmart, we're looking at you here, have been working on upping the click part of their business model. Amazon's coming at it from the other side.
We really are seeing a convergence between the physical and digital world when it comes to retail.
RJ Hadavi is an analyst at Morningstar.
It may look strange seeing Amazon as a physical store presence, but there are a lot of reasons to be excited about this.
Let's just tick those off. The deal helps Amazon grab more of the $600-plus billion U.S. grocery business, something it's been after for a while. Amazon could use the stores to accept returns, showcase products, and it gives Amazon hubs in upper-middle-class communities where a lot of Amazon Prime customers live. Here's Wharton School professor Barbara Kahn again.
And by having these stores in places, in the neighborhoods where people can go into the store and pick up things that they bought online is a huge asset.
For all the excitement over a brave new world of grocery shopping, this is not a slam dunk. Amazon's got to execute its vision. Whole Foods isn't at the top of its game. But still, it's probably not a good day to be a run-of-the-mill grocer, waking up to find your industry on the edge of massive disruption. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
All right, it is still Friday, and it is time for the weekly wrap. We're going to dive into this topic a little bit more, as well as some of the other happenings from the week. With me today are Lynette Lopez from Business Insider and Lee Gallagher from Fortune. Hello, rappers.
Hey, how's
it
going?
Hi, Molly.
Hi there. Business world shattered by this, earth has been shaken by this Amazon news. What I want to do is sort of look ahead into, you know, obviously grocery store stocks tumbled, but who else is worried now that Amazon is going to be coming for them? Lee, let's start with you.
I mean, I would start with anybody. I mean, Amazon has already shown that it, you know, it seems so quaint when Amazon only sold books. And now, you know, this is a big deal. I mean, there was so much breathless excitement over it. It's easy to wonder, is that, you know, some of that unfounded? These are two kind of emotionally resonant brands. You know, there's a lot of feelings pro and con about both of these brands. But I think that first and foremost, the supermarkets, as you said, but really anybody. I mean, you know, restaurants, you know, super, I mean, you know, drugstores. We don't know what Amazon is going to take over next. I mean, could it be the next ride-sharing company? The way it's going, that's why there's so much sort of enthusiasm over it, I think.
Yeah, Lynette, I keep seeing drugstores get brought up as a big, maybe even undersold target as part of this move.
Sure. I mean, what we're talking about is Amazon taking on a very complicated logistics challenge. If you look at what they're trying to do with the two flagship Amazon Go grocery stores that they've already opened, they're actually taking on something very complicated. You walk into the store, you take an item, you put it in your bag, that is immediately calculated. You put what you want on your phone and you walk out without talking to another human being. It's very complicated logistics, and in terms of coding, also complicated. So when you're talking about things like drugs, which already have specialty pharmacies, which are supposed to have, which have arisen in the last 10 or so years to take on and distribute really complicated medications, that's something that Amazon logistically and is starting to build the infrastructure to be able to do, because people need medicine as soon as possible. So, you know, you're giving them more brick and mortar stuff. You're seeing that they're willing to take on incredibly complex challenges digitally. And you know that Jeff Bezos obviously is not scared of anybody. So there's a lot of disruption possible here. I think that another thing to think about is just like all these retail jobs that are going to be changed. Now a retail person is somebody who's going to have to figure out how to manage these complex systems. It's not somebody who's going to be checking you out, because that checking you out person, that job is the first thing gone.
Lee, that's going to happen? Amazon has said they're going to run it as a standalone brand for now.
Yeah, they've said they're going to leave it alone. But of course, you know, one of the huge reasons why they did this is for the distribution network, for whatever they want to distribute, whether it's the long heralded plan for groceries that they've been dying to get into for a long time, or whether it's delivering anything that they sell. We don't know. And they've said that do not worry, we're not going to eliminate all these jobs. Amazon Go, which is that technology, is not going to be rolled out immediately everywhere. But you know, we don't know. And let's not forget that Amazon also runs Amazon Web Services, which is the, you know, cloud computing platform that powers almost everything on the internet and really upended the economics of information technology. So it's very separate. It's a whole separate. If it was a company, it would be enormous on its own. But this is, you know, lots could happen here.
Yeah, I mean, we've said more than once on this program that there's almost nothing you do online at this point that doesn't touch Amazon in some way. Now, if that comes offline too, I mean, at what point do we start talking about antitrust here, Lynette?
That's unclear. I don't think we've ever been down this road before. Again, these are all linked. If you really think about it now, Amazon is just becoming a massive infrastructure and logistics company. So where does that stop? Where does that start? This is uncharted territory, so I don't have answers for you.
And antitrust, it's – the businesses are complementary. I mean, Amazon sells groceries. It's just more of a platform change. But, you know, it just depends on where things go from here. The supermarket business is not an easy business. I mean, it's being disrupted also by all these meal kit delivery services. Maybe that's a very small percentage of the population, but, you know, I do it. I haven't stepped foot in a supermarket in months, and not even doing, you know, Prime or mail order delivery included.
I am jealous of you. Yeah. I do not want to go grocery shopping ever again. Jeff Bezos, if you're listening, thank you, sir.
I want to be acquired by
honey,
Jeff
there
Bezos,
are,
though.
I mean, you,
yes,
there are
please.
Deep pockets, technological expertise, like willing to win at all costs.
Jeff,
come on.
Daddy Warbucks Bezos. You heard
Let's
it here
go ahead
first.
And please invest. Please. Invest, Jeff. All right, so that's where it's come to. Instead of the hyper mega global com takeover, we embrace our Amazon overlords. All right, ladies.
Exactly.
Thank you
Hopefully
very much.
They are and, gentle and kind.
Exactly. Have a great weekend. On Wall Street today, Amazon's move did suck about $32 billion out of its competitors' market caps. More details on everybody else when we do the numbers. When it comes to cars and emissions, there are two forces pushing in opposite directions. There's DC on the East Coast and California out West. California has for decades had special permission to set stricter environmental rules than the federal requirements. The Trump administration had suggested it might try to revoke California's waivers. But in a bit of a surprise, EPA head Scott Pruitt says now that the feds will leave the state alone, at least for the moment. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Environmental rules for cars are complicated. There's miles per gallon. There's the number of electric vehicles on the road. There's tailpipe emissions. The key is, even if the feds dilute regulations, California says it will not. And its waiver, its permission to do that, is not under review, says EPA head Scott Pruitt. This could be a nod to reality, as rescinding the waiver is legally dicey, says Roland Huang at the Natural Resources Defense Council.
I think they're trying to keep their powder dry for other attacks. But in no way should this be seen as the Pruitt and Trump administration being enlightened about the environment.
12 other states have also signed on to California's strict rules. So when nearly half the nation's car market says jump, the automakers have to say, how clean? UCLA law professor Ann Carlson.
California standards are partially responsible for the development of the hybrid engine and for increasing the share of electric vehicles. Manufacturers have not always kept up with the kinds of technological trends that they really should be meeting.
Not that industry likes being nudged. Electric vehicles don't make much profit, and gas guzzlers do. Kelley Blue Book analyst Rebecca Lindland says manufacturers have already made big efficiency gains.
We've already moved from 8-cylinder engines down to 6-cylinder, from gas-guzzling SUVs into crossovers, much lighter. Now we're starting to get into things that are much harder and much more expensive.
Indeed, the auto sector may be the toughest part of the economy to cut carbon emissions. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
So a few things probably come to mind when you hear the word manufacturing. Giant factories, big burly dudes operating heavy machinery. But it might be time to rethink that, because there is a new group of entrepreneurs who are bringing smaller scale manufacturing back to America's cities. Dan Crocker of Minnesota Public Radio has that story.
3 decades ago, Duluth, Minnesota was in the doldrums. A steel mill had just closed. Unemployment was more than 20%. Someone posted a billboard on the way out of town that read, "Last one out, turn out the lights."
We were as rust belt as they come.
That's when Andy Goldfein rented an old 3-story brick building, bought a bunch of used sewing machines, and started a company called AeroStitch. His vision was to make motorcycle gear for hardcore riders to wear over their work clothes.
I thought if we made a summer coverall that could give me access to my motorcycle on more than weekends so that I could start commuting easily in street clothes, that maybe the other people would like that as well.
Think James Bond unzipping a wetsuit to reveal a tuxedo underneath. It took about 10 years for the idea to catch on, but now he ships around the world. Downstairs, he opened a retail store a few years ago. Walk upstairs, and it's like walking back in time.
Hello. Happy Monday. This is our sewing operation.
Light streams through big windows onto an open floor where sewers in cubicles hand make the gear. This is the kind of light manufacturing that left American cities decades ago for cheaper labor overseas. But AeroStitch employs more than 60 people. The most expensive coverall sells for over $1,000.
This is economic development at its finest.
Joel Bookman is a Chicago-based economic development consultant.
It's exporting products around the country and importing capital into Duluth.
In the last few years in this neighborhood in Duluth, several small manufacturers have joined together to brand themselves as a craft district that includes AeroStitch, breweries, potters, even a shoemaker. Many of these production jobs pay around 10 to 15 bucks an hour. And while data is hard to come by, anecdotally, this kind of small-scale manufacturing is spreading nationwide, from New York and San Francisco to smaller cities like Cincinnati and Portland, Oregon.
I wouldn't say a boom, but we're definitely seeing growth.
Adam Friedman directs the Pratt Center for Community Development in New York, which founded a group called the Urban Manufacturing Alliance. According to the U.S. Census, 2/3 of manufacturers employ fewer than 20 people. There are challenges to bringing manufacturing back to cities, mainly the cost of real estate or rehabbing old buildings. But other factors are pushing the trend forward. Technologies like 3D printing and computer-controlled machine tools are shrinking the size of factories and making them more environmentally friendly. That means they can return to dense urban neighborhoods that otherwise might not want them. And Friedman says customer preferences are changing.
People are just tired of sort of the homogenous production and the homogeneous products that you get in nationwide retail.
He says increasingly they want something that's locally made. Like here at another company in Duluth called Frost River, where Rose Loran is among the sewers who assemble heavy-duty canvas and leather packs.
When I make something, I want it to look really nice. And so if it doesn't look nice, then you don't want anybody to have it.
She says she has pride in what she does, a pride in making something that's slowly returning to American cities. In Duluth, Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
Coming up.
That's how they generate their livelihood in that community, and so they celebrate that.
Small towns that know how to throw a party. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 24 points, a tenth percent, to end at 21,384. The NASDAQ lost 13 points, two-tenths percent, to close at 6,151. The S&P 500 was off less than a point, basically flat, to finish at 2,433. For the week, the Dow advanced a half percent. The NASDAQ slipped nine-tenths percent. The S&P 500 increased less than a tenth percent. No surprise here, Amazon gained 2.4%. As we reported earlier, the online retail giant is offering to buy the upmarket grocery chain Whole Foods. Whole Foods bulk up 29%. Other supermarket chains, however, fell hard on the news. Kroger plunged 9.25%. Walmart shed 4.6%. Sprout Farmers Market discounted 6.2%. Tech stocks moved lower on concerns about valuations. Alphabet gave up a 10%, and Apple faded 1.4%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.15%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Hi, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Marketplace is here because these days it's essential to have an independent source explaining how the economy really works, not just for CEOs, but for everybody. Your support keeps this kind of reporting coming, and it's especially vital now at the end of our fiscal year. So please visit marketplace.org/donate to contribute and to keep us in your world every day. And thanks.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Every now and then we hear from people across the country about what the economy feels like to them. Today, a personal story from an immigrant from Melbourne, Australia, who's called this country home for nearly a decade, but who has felt some big changes in just the past few months.
I decided to move to the US almost 9 years ago to pursue acting and producing. I also nanny, which I find is a great job because obviously acting can be a little unpredictable, and I love kids. Kids are amazing. The working visa that I'm on, I have to renew every 3 years. And what happened to me at the start of the year was a little frustrating and stressful. We got a new president in January, and I went back to Australia to do my visa interview, and I let the family that I work for know that I'd probably be gone for 3 weeks, and they were completely fine with that. 3 weeks rolled around and I still did not have my visa approval. It turned out that there were administrative delays with the processing and they couldn't really provide a clear indication of when my visa would come through. The family that I'm working with now, I've been working with for a year, and I was worried I was going to lose my job. I mean, they were amazing. They just piecemealed help together. For 2.5 months, I was unable to get back into the United States, which obviously was incredibly stressful. I've lived here almost 9 years. I have my apartment here, my job, my car, my life. But I just kind of had to wait in Australia. So every day I was checking the news pretty frantically because the whole immigration climate was a little up in the air. I think, you know, with loss of wages and legal fees and whatnot, I mean, I was down probably $12,000. I am in the process of going for a green card now so that I don't have to deal with these renewals anymore. That's another whole story, though. I have to go back to Australia again for my interview for my green card. And again, it's a little unpredictable. It could take a week. It could take 2 months. It's a very uncertain time for foreigners in the United States. It feels like we're welcome, but we're not really welcome. In my community, none of us feel 100% confident about our ability to stay here, which is something that I haven't felt in the entire time I've been here until January.
That green card interview is this month, so we agreed not to use that listener's name. Here are just a few of the local festivals happening around America this weekend. The Washboard Music Festival in Logan, Ohio, the Jefferson County Watermelon Festival in Monticello, Florida, and the Brooklyn Park Tater Days Festival in Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. Festivals of all sizes are opportunities to bring communities together and drum up revenue for local businesses, and they are the latest topic in our annual series, Summer, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by
Rachel Carter is an economist with Mississippi State University's Extension Service, and she studies the economic impact of Mississippi town festivals. How are you, Rachel?
I'm doing well.
So you are based in Mississippi, and I understand that festivals are a big deal there, right? Is it a bigger deal than other states?
Well, there are hundreds of festivals in Mississippi. They're a part of our culture, and they're just a way for people to bring in tourists and showcase what their towns are all about. For example, in Vardaman, Mississippi, they're the sweet potato capital of the world, and so they have a sweet potato festival. That's how they generate their livelihood in that community, and so they celebrate that.
And why are there so many festivals, not just in Mississippi, but in local communities? I mean, I grew up in Montana. You know, we travel for railroad days, which is in like a town of 300 people. Do festivals bring in money for towns?
Absolutely. You see varying economic impacts from different types of festivals. For example, the Peter Anderson Arts and Crafts Festival, we just finished a study for that. And this year, their economic impact is just a little over $24 million in 2 days.
Whoa.
And so that's huge. And people always say, whoa, oh my goodness, I can't believe that small Ocean Springs can generate that. But they can because they have the local businesses to support it. Always caution towns, though, if you do have a very small town, you have to have very good relationships with the local merchants, because if the local merchants are aware that there's a festival going on or some type of an event, then they can prepare their businesses to be able to benefit from that. For example, if they know that there are going to be a lot of people at an event in Mississippi in August, you're going to want to make sure that you're able to sell cold beverages, that you have sunscreen available, fans, things that tourists would want to make an impulse purchase from.
But what are some of the costs associated if you're a town and you're thinking about putting on a festival? I imagine you could get yourself into trouble if you didn't plan carefully, right?
Yes, you have to definitely have a budget and know exactly who you're trying to reach. But the cost associated are also things that might not go into the budget, such as you're going to have increased police force. You're going to have to probably close some streets. You're going to have to make sure, you know, that there are public facilities available for people, things like that.
So, Rachel, let's talk about the kind of the sort of social and community benefit of a festival. Like, obviously, there can be an economic benefit, but does the community element build over time and provide other kind of positive impacts for a community?
What it can do is it can create something that the community can identify with and say, oh, I'm from XYZ town. And people say, oh, that's where you have this type of festival. And that builds a sense of community pride. And we really see the festivals that are more successful rally around that and offer something for the local community and a reason for them to become engaged and participate. And so a community will start an event wanting it to be just a tourism event, but they end up sometimes, in order for it to be successful, it has to have that local connectivity.
When I was growing up, I used to go to the Albuquerque Balloon Festival because my grandparents live there. And I will tell you that to this day, I still tell people if they say they're going to New Mexico, I say you have to go in October and go to the Balloon Fiesta.
There you go.
Stuff sticks with you.
Yes, yes. Now I want to go do that one.
Rachel Carter is an economist at Mississippi State University Extension Services. Thanks so much, Rachel.
Thank you.
This final note before we go, the Golden State Warriors held their big parade through downtown Oakland yesterday after winning their second NBA championship in 2 years. At the event, the team's owners announced that they would pay for the whole parade as a gift to the city. In 2015, Oakland spent about $250,000 on the Warriors Championship Parade. Last year, Cleveland spent about $600,000 when the Cavaliers won. The irony, of course, is that the Warriors are leaving Oakland, and they are paying to build a new billion-dollar stadium in San Francisco. That is unusual, too. A recent Brookings Institution report said taxpayers have spent over $3 billion building sports stadiums since the year 2000. And a group of senators planned this week to introduce a bill to stop teams from using tax-free municipal bonds to build new stadiums. The NBA and the NFL combined made almost $18 billion in 2016. And that's it for our week. Today, the Dow rose 24 points, a tenth percent. The Nasdaq lost 13 points, that's 0.2%. The S&P 500 was off less than a point. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fragali. Sitara Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I am Molly Wood. We will see you all on Monday. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.